These guys are opening up cans of worms faster than a North Carolina smallmouth bass tournament. Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today is a very strange type of episode because it's actually being re-recorded. Of the bazillion and a half episodes I've made, only one or two I've actually done a do-over on. The rest of them are first take, only take, and one take, start to finish. But this one, at the end, I felt like I just did a terrible job on. So you guys get take two, and this is it. The issue is, what's being presented here are all sorts of philosophical issues going, well, they should be going very deep, and they're all being presented at once, nonstop, and it's quite a tangled mess. So this is cutting the Gordian knot, not untying or untangling the Gordian knot. And that's what I'm going to try to do this time. There's certain things which are going to pop up in this conversation between Ben Shapiro and Alex O'Connor that I won't be able to get to. We're just going to have to skip them. If you really want me to cover them, email me, thegordianknot101@gmail.com, and I'll shoot that into a future episode. Okay, well, let's begin. We'll be playing a few clips from them and stopping a few places along the way.
Something's certain. We don't do cold opens or soft starts here on The Big Conversation. Alex.
Well, I am glad to begin on a point of agreement with you, Ben, that yes, if there is no God, there is no free will, but I think that...
And already we have to stop. It's interesting that these two thinkers believe that if there's no God, then there's no free will. There's a sense in which I agree. I think if there's no God, there's no ground of reality. If reality is never grounded, I don't see how it can exist. So free will and everything else would stop existing. But let's just assume that it were possible for there to be a universe much like this, but without God. Could free will exist? Well, I'm going to disagree with him. I think there's no problem. Sure, why not? If you were, let's say, an Aristotelian naturalist, you could take the position that there's just a natural world. It functions broadly the way that Aristotle thinks, without any type of, you know, divine first cause. We're going to have to nix that part. But sure, substances can have new and novel causal powers. One such substance would be the rational animal, like you and I. And one such power that a rational animal would have is the power to choose, the power to choose freely. What's the problem with that? So they make a big to-do about this. I don't think they really should be. I could imagine somebody simply defending the thesis that free will is something that could exist absent God. It's possible.
That's because of the truth of this, of the latter of those statements. That I suppose the biggest criticism that I made of you in a video response that I made to the atheist illusion, and this show does seem to have an extraordinary capacity for putting me face to face with people that I've been talking smack about online, so thanks again.
By the way, I should say it's a great video, and everybody should watch it if they haven't.
Well, I'm going to put that in the description, I think, that glowing endorsement. The principal disagreement that I think I had with you, Ben, is that there was a subtle, or not so subtle, implication, in my view, that yes, with no God, there's no free will. But somehow having God can solve this problem. I mean, you said a moment ago that you don't think you can establish God's existence through reason alone, but...
That's a big disagreement between, the Ben Shapiros, the Alex O'Connors, and, well, the Catechism of the Catholic Church that does believe that you can come to a certain knowledge of God through the light of natural reason. I think that a variety of the classic arguments for God's existence work. I really like Aquinas' five ways, minus maybe the fifth. I'm still thinking about that one. I don't think I understand it. And/or I'm not entirely sure it works, but certainly first way, second way, third way, fourth way, par excellence. All those seem to be strong rationales for believing in the God of classical theism. The De Ente argument, very good, very persuasive. Many great philosophers defend that as well. So I wouldn't be so pessimistic about what we can arrive at by reason.
Assuming that you do believe in the existence of free will, you think it's a real thing that you have.
Yes.
And simultaneously saying that if there is no God, then free will makes no sense.
Yes.
That does read to me like an argument for God's existence, such that in order to to either say that there is free will. In order to say that there is free will, one must believe in God. And that does strike me as an argument for God's existence.
So basically what he's pointing out is he's saying, if no God, then no free will. Free will, therefore God. And I just don't, yes, as that's set up, I suppose that would be an argument if you can prove those first two premises. Sure, you could arrive at God. However, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not convinced about that first one, that if no God, then no free will. That one I'm going to have to see spelled out a little bit more. I think it's very interesting they both take this for granted.
Slightly curve that, or to kind of sand off the rough edges there, I would say that the argument I made is an argument for something extra natural.
Sure.
Now, you can call that God or not God, but the thing that I'm making the argument for is that you cannot get from a materialist Darwinist universe to free will. That is not possible. So I know that the way you solve that is that you say that there is no free will.
That's right.
And what I'm saying to you is you don't act that way.
Yeah, so he's pulling up two different issues. One, can a materialist naturalist universe get you to free will? And B, are we being consistent in our worldview? So for the first one, it depends how we describe naturalism and materialism. If we take a Aristotelian view and say, sure, we're just an Aristotelian naturalist, then I could see ways that we could imagine certain substances with certain new novel causal powers, like the one to choose and choose freely. Not a big deal. But if we're going to take the traditional materialist move of denying that there's any type of, say, substantial form, and we're reducing things from the four causes that Aristotle lists, right? The material, efficient, formal, and final. And we just knock it down to like efficient and material. Then, yeah, I agree. In that type of universe, I don't see how free will can function. Because we're not, and as we'll see, this argument goes in this exact direction, we're not saying that free will is seated in any given part or a variety of parts. We're saying it's actually seated in the whole, the subject, the person, the free willer. He's the one who's making the choice, not a part, not a piece. And if all you have in your ontology are parts and pieces and not wholes and forms, then yeah, you're going to have some issues down the line. Oh, what about this whole you don't live that way? Now, we're going to get a little discussion between the two of these about what that might mean. And I'm going to kind of side with Alex O'Connor because although this is a common charge against people who deny free will, it's also a common charge against people who are Calvinist. It's really unclear how you actually answer that. I don't know what it would look like to live in a world where there was no free will when, well, first, we need a very narrowly tailored definition of free will to begin this thought experiment. And second, we do seem to have the ability to act according to one's nature. I mean, yeah, well, let's keep on going with the discussion, but just keep that in mind.
I hear this all the time. People say, look, you may say there's no free will, but you don't act as though that's the case. I suppose that I'm just confused as to what it would look like for somebody to act as if they believe there was no free will. I mean, the very argument that there is no free will that I subscribe to, at least one of the various forms that it takes, is a sort of Schopenhauerian view that you can do as you will, you just can't will what you will.
Now that's where I get off the O'Connor boat real hard. I don't think anything's less true than that statement. You can't will what you want to will, I think is what he said, or you can't choose what you want to will. Boy, we just passed New Year's, where the majority of people on Earth made an act of will about the things they want to will. I want to like exercise. I want to not eat as much cake so I can finally lose weight. Right? We're making choices about the desires we wish our future selves to have. So, sorry, Schopenhauer, I think that's fundamentally false, and I just don't see that principle arising in at least my experience of self.
And that you are essentially just a biological machine reacting to its internal and evolutionary drives. That's what's happening. Now, call that nihilistic if you like. That's a separate question. But as to the question of how this would make one act, the idea that this might cause us to sort of lay around in bed all day or something, the very mechanism that I think is responsible for eliminating the possibility of free will. That is, the drives that make people do what they do. Like I say, do exactly that. Make people do what they do. They make them get out of bed in the morning. Why do you get out of bed and go and make your breakfast if there's no free will? So you go and get breakfast because there's no free will and something is driving you to do that. That's outside.
Yeah, so I think he's kind of straw-manning the case a little bit. What we're agreeing with here is not, I think, a huge point. Aristotle would talk about every being wishes to preserve itself in being. So you don't need free will to get up and eat a sandwich. You just need to be a regular, ordinary being with the one addition that you require, in this case, sustenance in the form of a sandwich to continue in existence. So we would just expect, based on the nature of things, that, yeah, we would do those types of self-perfective activities. Plants, animals, other things that don't have free will still get out of their proverbial beds in the morning and make themselves breakfast.
If you'll control.
For sure.
And Ben Shapiro just kind of agrees with this. Like, that's not the main thrust of anybody's argument. So Ben just goes, yes, I know. And he continues.
Get back to the nihilism point, which you kind of put aside. So that means that this conversation is essentially worthless in any sort of real sense. I mean,
and there we go with Ben Shapiro making a straw man. So there is an issue of nihilism. That's true. But I don't think that we could call such a conversation worthless. I think that's a stretch. So what he lists off with everything is just a biological urge, which you did not decide, and the effect of your environment on you, which you also didn't decide. Well, that means that whatever you means, you're just kind of like a little ping pong ball bouncing about with no real choice in the matter. And that's a pretty nihilistic thing to think about. Where I disagree with Ben here is that this conversation that they would be having would be meaningless or useless, because that implies that their minds can't change. So let's assume they didn't have free will, but let's assume that there is some type of advantage for, say, Ben Shapiro winning the debate. Well, then if Ben does provide different arguments, which maybe even deterministically determine good old Alex to change his mind, then Ben will be quite happy and just tell a biological story. He'll have dopamine and who knows what other things surging through his head. Beneath the yarmulke will be a veritable panoply of wonderful chemicals as he realizes he has defeated Alex O'Connor in this debate. Well, that would seem to be quite valuable to him. That would seem to achieve some type of biological purpose for him. Great. What's wrong with that? That the conversation is not useless because it can make a change when a change was intended. That's not what we're talking about with free will. We all accept that beings can make choices. Your dog can make a choice. Lots of things can make choices. A computer can, quote unquote, make a choice. But what we're talking about is something more narrowly tailored. Is there free will?
Effectively, we were driven here by evolutionary biology and environment to have this conversation. Everybody who's watching this is driven by evolutionary biology and environment to have a particular reaction to that thing, and ever round the cycle goes. That seems like a very purposeless life. Maybe, again, I'm drawing from a realm that is not evolutionarily, biologically, connected. The word purpose is really, teleology obviously has been just taken out of the realm of science pretty thoroughly by atheists and by many people in the sciences, although I would argue that, again, most scientists speak in the realm of teleology literally all the time, and they're borrowing language from the language of teleology, even when they're describing functions of particular body parts, right? The heart pumps blood in order to keep you alive, right? They're constantly using language that's teleological in nature. Mm-hmm. The real question that I have, and this is what goes to the question that you were asking at the beginning, before the sort of pre-question, which was the good of religion to society. One of those goods is people believing that their free will matters and this actually is a useful thing. So I believe that it is deeply important for people in society to believe that they have the capacity to change themselves and to make different decisions than what biology would drive them to. So you say, well, it's biology that drives you to get out of bed in the morning.
I kind of agree. But, there's that old Greek story. What's it about? Blanking on the guy's name. But basically the story is he has this fate. What's his name? Oh, You know who I mean. The guy who ends up sleeping with his mother and killing his father, right? So the fates decide that this is going to happen. I believe he's given this prophecy. He tries to flee from it, but in the act of fleeing from it, he ends up bringing it about. And there's many such stories. What this shows is that, at least in these stories, there's no real contradiction between fate and one's free choice. And I think that's largely true. The fate would still happen, but it would come about as a result of your free choices. So in the case of a society that says, there's no, like, even if we said, hey, everything is determined in this way or not, they would have a, maybe not a full-fledged, beefy free will, but they would be able to make a variety of choices. And then they would find retroactively that that's what biology indicated that they ought to do. So I don't think it takes away one's ability or drive or ability to focus on a given change. It would just mean that once they make that choice or they cause that change to take place, they would understand that as having come from biology and not from free will. So I could imagine a religion, say Calvinism, that drops out free will and still demands moral perfection. One that says what you choose is what you always would have ended up choosing. So choose well, and you'll have ended up choosing well when you reach that point, right? So we could construct something like that. And I think he's pushing it a little bit too strong. Thomas Aquinas doesn't defend free will from saying, hey, there's meaning in the universe, but with no free will, it'd be just nihilistic. Therefore, we have free will. That's kind of one line of argument. I don't see Aquinas laying that out. I mean, maybe you could defend that, but I don't see it intuitively. The other one is, hey, it's far more useful. Maybe useful reflects a true pattern of reality. Therefore, okay, this is a real thing. That's also interesting, but I would rather root it in something like the nature of a rational creature. That's what Aquinas does. That's what many other thinkers do. They look at what does it mean to be rational? And they find that any rational creature would have, as a result of their rationality, also the power to will. That, I think, is a bit more philosophically rigorous, and I think we can defend those premises a lot easier. He doesn't take that tact, and I don't know, maybe I'll read some of what Aquinas has said. Actually, I think I already did. So go back to the episode on free will, determinism, and hell, and I reflect on the thought of Aquinas, St. Augustine, Plato, Aristotle. I pull in a couple other Greek schools as well, and you'll get my more full laid out thoughts on the issue of free will, how that fits into our ontology, how exactly it works, and how we can choose in a way which goes over and above just the powers of our constituent parts. So go back to that episode if you want a deep dive on that. I'll just stop here by saying I'm not thrilled with the two arguments or lines of thought that Ben Shapiro is pulling out to defend his thesis,
which is almost Calvinist in sort of the way that it's described, right? It's like you're predestined to get out of bed in the morning, so thus you get out of bed in the morning. But the reality is that we are constantly making decisions as though those decisions make a difference in the universe. And what
Calvinists would say, those decisions do make a difference in the universe. However, we would have to look outside of ourselves for the reason why ourselves made the decision that made a real change in the universe. So I'd say that the Calvinists have thought deeply about this, and although I don't think they're right about everything, they could provide a fair rebuttal to this.
Social science actually does tend to show us that when people believe that they have control over their own actions, that when they believe that they're capable of changing the way that they live, they do make those changes with more alacrity and in better directions than if they don't believe that. If people tend to believe in a deterministic universe, they do act worse. So it may work. This is going to be sort of Straussian in its implications, but that may work for you. You're a very high IQ individual who can somehow reconcile the idea of living a very purposeful life with the idea that actually there's no purpose to anything. But for the vast majority of people, that is not actually how they live. And I would suggest that even in your daily life, you don't get out of bed in the morning thinking, man, My biology is driving me this morning to get on the bike, have a great day. The sun is shining. That's my biology doing this. And I don't think that most people who live purposeful lives, even if they believe that everything they're doing is predetermined by the world around them, by their own biology, I don't believe they actually feel that. They have to engage in what they themselves would term an illusion in order to feel a sense of purpose and meaning in their lives.
Of course, but that's what the evolutionary process, in my view, in my worldview, I should say, has done so well, is...
Ooh, let's stop right there. Yeah, I think Ben's broadly right there. I think I've been a bit too hard on him, and I'm sure that the social science shows exactly that. Now, the point that Alex brings up here is, yeah, there's this illusion that we have that our choices, when we're choosing, are actually us choosing. And this is really just like a simulation that evolution has brought about. Now, I think this one's very problematic, and we might get into the weeds a little bit. Let me lay something out for you. If you guys haven't picked up good old Pat Flynn's book, do that. Flip to the section on evil, and I'm going to be making an argument that's quite similar to his argument about functionalism and suffering and that stuff. So here's basically what I'm thinking. When Alex is laying out, and he'll do this later, a defense of why he believes there can be no free will, and what he said right there about we're driven by biology and these different environmental factors, he's laying out this case that basically everything that we do is caused by like a part of us or something outside of ourselves, and it's not us as a whole choosing. So if you imagine there's you and there's all the parts and everything that went into you, all of the causal arrows in his mind are heading from your organs, from your neurons, from your the chemicals bouncing around your brain up to the decision. There is nothing coming from your conscious first-person understanding of self and self as a free chooser down to cause changes in your biology, okay? And that's very important. He thinks that all of the actual function of your choice, all of the cause of your choice is bottom-up, not top-down. All right, so that's the first thing we've got to have. One picture that's commonly laid out is we have this ocean that's churning and moving. It's doing all this change. And floating on top is this foam. You've heard me and Pat talk about this in other episodes. And that foam, that froth, is just kind of floating above the waves. That is the equivalent of your conscious understanding of self and your qualia. You're seeing things as red and blue. And you're experiencing suffering. And you're experiencing the concept of actually choosing things, all this qualitative stuff. It's just the foam that's riding on top of these biological, chemical, ultimately like atomic or superstring or quantum processes, which are the churning, bubbling sea underneath. So the foam is not causing the ocean to go up and down or anything. It's just riding the waves, being sent up and down by the ocean. Now, the issue here is, okay, if there's no function that, say, our consciousness, qualitative operations, all this stuff, our understanding of being a decision maker is actually doing, well, then wait a minute. Hang on. How could it be biologically selected for, right? Why would this have to match the function of what's going on underneath? There need not be any connection between the actual function and then the actions and the experience thereof. And if that made no sense, let me give you a few examples. First, there is an experiment where in order to stop seizures, they would, I guess it was an experiment operation back in the 60s, 70s, where they would sever the corpus callosum, so the section between your right and left hemisphere. And this meant that the right and left side of your brain didn't know what the other side was doing. Now, your ears are actually connected to one side of the brain or others, and then they communicate through. I believe it's actually your left is connected to your right and vice versa. So they could speak to one side of the brain or the other. So they would whisper to the participant, hey, pick up that pencil. And then that side of the brain can pick up the pencil. But the other side, the right side of the brain, is kind of like the press secretary for your brain. And then they would ask the person, hey, why'd you pick up the pencil? Now, they, on the right side of the brain, had no knowledge of the fact that they were told, hey, pick up the pencil. So they just came up with a story. Oh, I just remembered I need to write a grocery list. And then later they tried another one where they whispered, hey, we need you to walk out of the room and just head out the door, okay? Okay, got it. Yeah, sure. And then they asked in the other ear, then they get up, they actually do the right thing in response to that stimulus, and they walk out of the door. And they ask, and it's heard by the other side, hey, where are you going? And they spin a story. They just say, oh, I'm so sorry. I had something in the oven at my apartment. I got to get it out. I don't want it burning. That had nothing to do with it. But what it does show is that first person experience of why you made the choice, how you made the choice, what's going on, the meaning of the world, all of that need not match the actual function. There's no reason why we couldn't have evolved in an African savanna where a lion comes at us and our body, our biology, everything beneath the quote-unquote foam does the right thing. It darts away from the lion, and we have the experience of, you know, I think I needed a run. I need some exercise. Getting a little flabby. I figured this would be a perfect time to take a job, to take a jog. You know, that saves you just as much as if you have this understanding that this is a lion, and I am a mortal creature, and I will die if it rips me to shreds. So we could have had a substitute experience that did not need to match. Every time we touch a hot stove and it hurts, we could totally just have felt the sensation of, smelling cinnamon. But so long as we do the right thing, no, the survival effects are the same. Let me just give you one last example. Okay, maybe two. here's two more examples. If you're sleeping and you're a sound sleeper, I could take a pin and I could poke your hand with the pin and you'll pull your hand away and you'll probably frown in your sleep. Well, that's an example of when there is no conscious experience of pain, but your biology did the exact right thing. You pulled your hand away, right? There you go. Last example, I promise. AI. Decides to destroy humanity and create these cyborg-like bodies that can somehow reproduce in an analogous way to the way that we produce and make little baby cyborgs. Pretty much everything's destroyed, and they find themselves, weirdly, on the African savanna. Lions like to destroy them for fun. They can't eat them, but they just like to destroy them. It's fun for them. And they're in a very similar situation to us. Now, being machines, they don't have a self, they are not conscious, and there is no qualitative operation going on in them whatsoever. There is no meaning, there is no conception that they are making a choice, nothing. All there is raw mechanical computing power. And they can compute that I will be ripped to shreds by that lion if I don't run. So the ones that don't run get ripped apart. They continue to reproduce, ergo, we get all the ones with the software or the hardware or the whatever to run away from lions. So that's an example of we don't need any qualitative anything in order to get the proper function and to evolve in a perfectly reasonable way. Which means if there is no biological selective pressure to have the type of qualitative experiences that do demonstrably meet what's going on biologically, and that's what their claim is, then their naturalistic, materialistic worldview does not in any way predict the actual state of affairs that we find ourselves in. It does not predict this. Instead, we seem to have something that was not evolved biologically that allows for this understanding of meaning, these qualitative senses, understanding of will, this type of reasoning that matches the real world, which, let me say one more time, does not have to be, because you could do the right function and that could be selected for just as easily. We have this thing. That's highly predicted under the theistic view that contains ideas like a soul, something that's immaterial, something that's not the product of a biological evolutionary process, and something which is densely in touch with universals, something which, you know, Aristotle argues in De Anima how exactly that is, the idea you'd need something immaterial to come in contact with the immaterial universality of concepts like numbers and triangularity, etc. But that's a subject for a different podcast. Okay, there you go. That's the critique that we have here. I know we got a wee bit carried away, but he's saying that evolution has given us this operating system layer, which provides an illusion of meaning, gives us all these other things which we've been listing. However, that's not something in the dude's own worldview that would be biologically selected for, because it has no causal arrows downward. Ergo, it cannot confer survival benefits. It's simply a crazy wild coincidence, which I think needs some explanation, Alex, and you've not given. Let's keep going.
Provide precisely that illusion. I mean, it's not as though, I mean, you say, look, you don't get out of bed in the morning thinking, gosh, you know, look at my biological...
My neurons are firing, yeah.
of course not, because if I did, then the whole evolutionary purpose that this illusion serves would fall away. I mean, you say that this is a fairly purposeless life, and perhaps, you know, the implication is that it's a bit of a depressing one. I didn't come here to inspire optimism in people. I just think it is in fact the case.
By the way.
It is in fact the case that free will doesn't exist. And we may feel very nihilistic towards that, but as a wise man once said, facts don't care about your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And
very true.
I will say that the argument against free will, in my view, is based upon something broader than just scientific analysis or empirical research. Rather, we can build an argument, I think, from a law of logic, the proposition that P must either be true or false, and it can't be both, it can't be neither. It has to be one or the other.
Sure.
Now, this law of the excluded middle, one of the foundational precepts of philosophy, we can simply ask a question of any kind of mental activity, and this will be regardless of whether it's material or immaterial. That's what makes this a crucial argument, and an important one, a pertinent one, is that you can ask of that mental activity, is it determined or is it not? That is it determined by anything else, or is it completely undetermined by anything? If it's undetermined by anything, then it's random, and you're by definition not in control of that which is random. If it's determined by something, then it's either determined by something further in...
Ooh, let's stop right there. I hate to be a stickler, but this guy is a Oxford-trained philosopher, as I know. I think he's studying. He may have graduated at this point. But he's being pretty sloppy here. So he said there's either determined or undetermined. And then he goes on to say that undetermined is random. Not really. So there's, if we mean by undetermined, we mean a brute fact. Well, that could be one case. If we mean by undetermined, indeterminate? As in, it's an indeterminate cause, like some quantum effects. So it's not violating rationality. It simply has more than one possible logical outcome from an initial state. That would be indeterminate. We have random. Random, really, if you want to kind of push it, and I'm sure people use this in different ways, but I'd say the best definition I know is that this is the type of thing which would not present a bell-shaped distribution. It would not give any distribution at all. It's entirely unbounded, be random. Something that's indeterminate could create some type of distribution. An example would be, say, the decay of a radioactive isotope. Each individual point is indeterminate, meaning from the initial state, it could logically take a variety of different paths. For instance, decay at time one or decay at time two. Any of those are fine. None of those are irrational, but it's not determined to do time one or time two. It's just determined to eventually decay. And once it does, that creates like an average house half-life when we take it together. So that's an indeterminate cause. He could be saying that. I don't know. He could be saying random, meaning there is no distribution whatsoever. But note, this is still different from brute. Let's say I had something which truly was random. Well, that doesn't mean that it's completely brute, meaning there is no explanation, right? This gets us into some PSR, principle of sufficient reason, or pumpkin spice reason, if you will. I guess not that season. If we take let's imagine that I had a very, very special coin, and the coin would actually just give a random outcome, a truly random outcome. When I flip it and it comes up heads, for instance, what would we say of that? Would that be a brute fact that it became heads? Well, no, it wouldn't, because we could simply explain the fact that it's heads based on the fact that I flipped it. It's a random outcome from this magic coin. Ergo, it is heads. No problem. So we haven't put bruteness in, but we have put in randomness. These two are not synonymous. So as we go through, he uses undetermined and random as the same thing. I'd really have to know what he means by those terms. Strictly speaking, I don't think they're synonymous. I think it's a bit of a jump to say that anything undetermined would be random. That's a puzzling thing to say. And, you know, for reasons like the example I just gave. I gave something that is determined by something, right? It has a cause. It's not a brute fact, but it is random. So maybe I have to dive into some of the work, what he means by this. Till then, I'm going to try to spell out all the possible things that he could be saying, and we'll analyze which ones make sense.
Inside your mind, or inside your brain, or indeed inside your soul, or it's determined by something external to your brain. If it's determined by something external to yourself, I should say yourself rather than your brain here to rid this conversation of any implicit materialism, exterior to yourself. If that's what's determining the action, then clearly you're not in ultimate control of that action. If it's something inside of yourself somewhere, then all you do is push the problem back and you ask the question again. Is that thing determined or is it indeterminate? It's indeterminate, it's random, determined. You keep going back until you either terminate in something outside of the self, something, or I suppose something undetermined and therefore random, either of which you are completely out of control in. If you say that it terminates in something like a soul, people like to do this, they say, well, look, with a religious philosophy, we have the benefit of introducing a soul. That doesn't solve anything. Because you still need to, it's not a matter of having to explain the mechanism by which the soul brings about actions. That may well be a mystery. But if it is the case that whatever it is that's doing that is either determined or it's not, and that if it's not, it's random and therefore out of your control, and that if it is, it ultimately terminates in something outside of yourself or something random, and both of which are out of your control, free will cannot exist. Well,
all right, cool. So that's his argument. Very similar argument I made back in the day, back when I was a Calvinist. I would run something almost identical to this. So it's interesting that he forgot a category, and I did too, so I don't blame the guy. He says it's either causes, he says it's either random or determined, which is outside, or random or determined, which is inside of yourself. So it's either things outside, or it's a part of oneself. I think you probably already spotted the glaring error here, because there's something missing, and that is the self as such, the self as a whole, right? And he seems to think that, let's just take what it seems to be his own rules, that we can't just stop at this self, because he's excluded as a category, and say it explains it. But weirdly, he doesn't abide by this rule, because one possibility he does offer for a choice, he wouldn't say it's a free will choice, but a choice is, oh, we found the part in the brain. He offers that as an example. It could be a part of the brain making the choice. All right, Alex, let's say we did it. It's the prefrontal cortex. That's the part that's making the choice. Well, wait a minute. Can't we apply Alex's argument again? How can we say it's this thing as a whole? Doesn't it have to be either outside or a part thereof? Now, at this point, he might say, ooh, darn it, you got me. I guess we can say it's as a whole, the prefrontal cortex. At which point I'd say, well, Alex, why can't we just say it's as a whole, not a section of your brain, but you as the type of creature you are? Why can't I say it's your whole brain? Why can't I say it's your whole person? Why can't I say it's you, inclusive of your first-person conscious experience, including your experience of choosing? How come you allowed us to choose this smaller whole that we call the prefrontal cortex, but you're denying me the choice to choose the larger whole, which just is you? Now, the other possibility is he says, no, I'm going to abide by my own rules, where we seem to be saying no to the whole and only yes to the parts as an explanation. Well, at that point, well, what part of it is the prefrontal cortex? Well, maybe it's these neurons. Well, what part of the neurons then? Oh, I guess it would have to be these electrical charges. Well, what part of that? Well, as you can see, we're actually heading further and further away from what we would need for the explanation. I don't think you're going to find the reason for an intention or the reason for a qualitative experience of licking a peppermint ice cream cone in electrical charges or in collapsing quantum fields. I think you only find that in persons, relatively whole and entire. So that would be what I'd say here, is that you're denying the possibility of a whole, and you're actually setting up an infinite regress, which no clear point of termination, and yet you want an outcome from it? It's not going to work. So the infinite regress, always reaching back to something which is presumed to be more fundamental in order to get things which seems to relate to the whole as such, I think that's a really bad move. I think, strictly speaking, that type of regress would be impossible. So that leaves us with, why don't you just affirm that the self can make a choice? That's the obvious stopping point. And let's get back to his earlier points about determined or undetermined and randomness. Let's pretend that what he means by undetermined is brute. That's one way that we could analyze his argument. So here he would be saying that brute would mean it's something which would seem to call out for an explanation, and yet there simply is none. We simply stamp our foot and we say this is the way reality is. So we can imagine a floating kitten in space. And we would say, why would there be that? Is there a reason? Was that brought about? What's the grounding for the existence of this kitten? And a brute fact way of answering this question is, the kitten's there, and that's that. He's just floating. He's just in space. I'm going to stamp my foot and say, it is the way it is. Full stop. There is no reason that comes prior to explain the persistence of this cat in space. Well, if he's saying that this is a real possibility in reality, these brute facts, that we can simply stamp our foot and say that something is in existence without any type of reason, well, now that that's on the table, hey, Alex, free will exists. Stamped my foot. It exists. Why? Stop it. I don't have to answer why. Brute facts are on the table, buddy. We're good to go, all right? So I don't think you want to make that move. You don't want to just say, well, undetermined would mean a brute fact, right? Another option is you're saying there's determined, meaning there is from state one only state two. And then the other option is it's random, meaning from state one, there are options state one, two, three, four, and five. And I'm perfectly fine with this. I think that this is a real feature of reality. For instance, there's a guy, his name escapes me. I'm doing a terrible job remembering things today. There's a fellow who's a mathematician, who imagines this like apex point. So you, like imagine like a sphere or something. And at the very top of this arc, we place a single point, and this point has mass. Now, interestingly, there are two entirely valid mathematical ways to solve what happens to this thing with mass. Option one is it stays on the apex forever. Option two is it goes in one direction. Any direction. Any direction is fine. All of these are perfectly reasonable outcomes, and we can arrive at these rationally. Now, in this case, I would call that point, that singular point, leaving the apex and taking a path, let's say, to the left. I would say that there is a cause for that. It's not breaking what's called the principle of sufficient reason. The reason is it's a thing with mass. It's on the apex, and there's a mathematical formula to show that it would leave that point. One entirely consistent thing for it to do would be to go to the left. That would just be a random effect, sure, but it's not breaking the principle of sufficient reason. There are things that we have that are causal antecedents which bring this about. They could also bring something else about, but it turns out they brought this about. No problems. All right, so if we take that interpretation, which I think is the other way we can read what he's saying, weirdly, and I do mean weirdly, it seems to be that Alex O'Connor is defending a form of the principle of sufficient reason, whereby he says everything has to have some type of sufficient reason for it being brought about. Either it's random, and random things, if we're not interpreting him as saying brute, would have some type of sufficient reason antecedent to them, or they're just deterministic, at which point, well, there's really not much to explain. This is just a clear causal chain. Well, I'm not entirely sure as an atheist he wants to make that move, because to my limited knowledge, the majority of professional atheistic philosophers would not want to accept the principle of sufficient reason because it can railroad you to theism quite quickly. And there's a variety of arguments for God which rest on this assumption, and the number one reason for denying the principle of sufficient reason is to wiggle out of theistic conclusions. Now, Alex seems to be defending the principle of sufficient reason, which is not terribly compatible with his atheism. And interestingly, he's defending the principle of sufficient reason in order to get rid of free will. But if he holds to this PSR and he gets God, well, then God could bring about free will. So he's in a very funny situation. So if he accepts free will, he already has this idea that it would be impossible without God. So the whole conversation kicked off with if no God, then no free will. But if there was free will, then God. So if he affirms free will, he's going to have good reason to affirm God based on the other things that he said. But if he uses his own argument to deny free will, he affirms the PSR. And affirming the PSR can quite quickly get you God. So either way you go, Alex, I see you getting back to God, either by the PSR or by affirming free will. And then if you take the idea that, all right, I'm not meaning randomness in the way that this podcast dude described it, instead, I'm laying it out more as like brute versus determined, well, then I'm just going to stamp my foot and say free will's a brute fact. Bite me. Okay, let's keep going.
That argument does rely on the complete deconstruction of the self.
Good job, Ben. Yes, that's kind of the point we were making, that something could choose according to a whole. There could be a self.
I mean, you're using the term self in this argument in, I think, a couple of different ways. You're saying something outside yourself, but then you're breaking down the self into a bunch of separate components as though the self is a computer. Right, so if you took the self and you broke it down into a machine, and there's the microchip, and you've got the processor, you've got all these different parts of it. So it has to be coming from here, or it has to be coming from here. But I think the very idea that we have of ourselves as selves is as a deciding being. And so the attempt to carve that down into, so which parts of the deciding being, that is an avoidance strategy, But so I don't think that the argument quite holds. So if we
can we just take a brief moment to be pretty proud of Ben Shapiro? I think he did a great job answering that. A lot of people think he's just this really angry conservative host who really doesn't think terribly deeply into things. But I think he's pretty much holding his own here and contributing some good stuff to the conversation. Like, that was a very good answer. So kudos, Ben.
Called herself just
a deciding being.
Then that sort of fundamental assumption that we make about the nature of the self, I don't think is going to be incompatible with atheism.
How so?
Because we're talking about what the self is here. I mean, atheists believe in the self. Everybody believes in the self.
Well, no, that's not. I mean, that I find difficult to believe. Why would an atheist believe?
Yeah, so you could carve out yourself a very strange atheist position where you accept that there's this real thing as a whole. You accept forms, you accept souls, you accept everything but God. You could take that like Aristotelian naturalistic position. Do I think that's going to slide you to theism real fast? Yeah, I really, really do. In general, I think that they're right, that if you're going to be like a classic naturalist, like a more materialist, then no, you don't actually have form and finality in your toolkit. You got material and you got efficient causes, and you're not really going to get self there. You're going to be simply saying that you are parts, and we just make this... We just draw a circle around your parts, and we just call that a Alex O'Connor or a Ben Shapiro. And there's no real truth of the matter as if there's something which determines these parts to truly be a whole. And Alex has been pressed on this before. Is the only other video I've ever heard him on, I think. And or maybe I heard one more. But he was talking to William Lane Craig, and Craig is advancing stuff, and Alex just retreats to what's called mereological nihilism. The idea that there are no holes, there are no things, everything is pieces, everything is parts. And Craig's just like, buddy, do you know the cost of that view? Do you know how deeply incoherent that is? Do you know how weird it would be to say that there's no real separation? It's only something that we project on reality to say that there's a cat and a couch. And instead we could have just drawn the limit between cat and couch anywhere. Why can't the couch have little fuzzy ears? It seems just as rational as saying there's a cat in a couch. No, that's not something that's coherent. We do need to affirm some type of whole. And we could even say, what exactly would be doing the drawing of these arbitrary boundaries if there is not some type of arbitrary boundary drawer as such, as a whole, to arbitrarily draw boundaries? So I don't think that mereological nihilism can hold. I don't think that you can get anything other than that, ultimately, without smuggling in ideas like form, ideas like finality, into your ontology. You might not know that you smuggled it in, but I think you do have to do that.
Believe in the self. The self is a series of non-deciding mechanisms, as you described. I see that your view of the self is an atheist view of the self, a meatball wandering through space, as I've put it somewhat colorfully, the sort of Spinoza idea that you're a stone that's been thrown, and you can comprehend that you've been thrown, but you're a stone that's been thrown, and that's just the way that it is. Why would there be in atheist philosophy such a thing as a deciding self? The deciding self, the deciding being, is external to the idea of an evolutionary cause, because the very word deciding suggests uncaused decision making, and you've just excluded it through your own philosophy.
Uncaused decision making, I suppose, is a concept that I think is unintelligible.
Ooh, let's stop right there. I kind of agree and disagree with everybody all at the same time. So I don't think that when you make a free will decision, that's an uncaused decision. I think it's caused, and I think it's caused by you, the deciding being. And I think Ben was kind of affirming that, and maybe you got a little tripped up here. I think Alex is right that it doesn't make sense to say there is an uncaused decision, which, let me remind you, if we're going to rule that out and we say it's entirely unintelligible to imagine a, say, decision or really anything else, just without a cause at all, then you're ruling out bruteness, you're supporting a form of the PSR, and you're well on your way to theism. So, weird situation here.
So if there is an unintelligibility of the self on atheism, I suppose the thrust of the criticism that I made to essentially every point you made in that video, except for the argument from motion, is that what you're saying to me, if it applies to atheism, I think simultaneously applies to theism as well.
How so?
An uncaused decision. I mean, what is the process by which a decision is made?
He's saying there needs to be a process for a uncaused decision. So we already addressed the idea that we don't think they're uncaused, but let's talk about this process part. Do you think that there needs to always be a process in order to make a decision? So let's say I have the decision to eat a delicious sandwich after this, which may be my decision. Well, okay, is it necessary that I, as a choosing free creature, have a process? And let's just define that as a state prior to that happens in my little choosing free-willing mind. Well, let's take yes. Let's imagine that reality is set up like this. We need that. Well, hang on. It seems like we're in danger of an infinite regress here because, well, wait a minute, I needed to use my mind to initiate this process. But I thought that any type of thinking like this requires a process of its own, which means my process needs a process. The thing which happened prior to my thought, that type of thought requires a thought. And now we're on an infinite regress, and it's actually a legitimate infinite amount of intermediate steps between me at state one and me making a choice or having a thought or doing anything else for that matter. And you can't actually traverse an infinite real series of steps. So that's got to be off the table. So instead, we have to say it's a finite group. Well, wait a minute. We could just stop at Occam's razor. Why, if we already affirmed that it's finite, we don't always need a process prior in order to bring about, say, a thought or a decision, or we can apply this in a variety of domains. If it's already finite, how about we just need one thing? Me, as a choosing being, and then my choice. Boom. Why do we need an intermediate? I can just have a thought. I can just make a decision. And it's not rooted in a process, it's just rooted in me as something with the causal power to decide or to think. This kind of gets a little, let's throw an example in, that might clarify. What we're rooting a decision in is a decision maker, and a decision maker is adequate to make a decision. It's similar to claims we make about much more mundane things, and we don't push into their parts because we realize we're getting further away from the explanation. If I say, why is this salt salty? The correct answer is because it's salt. Right, but what's the process by which salt makes something salty? Oh, I got it. By being salt, we don't appeal to a process that would be further from our explanation. Likewise, we wouldn't say it's something outside of it. No, it just comes from its own nature, being salt. Oh, I got it. Alex's other idea. It comes from a part. What part of the salt makes it salty? No, you fundamentally misunderstand. It's not a part of it. That's sodium or chloride or atoms and protons. Those aren't salty. Those are atomic or protony or neutrony or electrony. Or moving up, we have or chloride-y. There you go. That works better. But they're not salty. It's only salty when it's salt. So when we're talking about people who are decision makers, who are free willers, we don't go to a piece because that's further from the explanation. We don't go outside because that's not relating to it. And we don't have to look for this series of steps, this process. Well, because that gets us away from the fact of a substantial form which has a distinctive causal power. In this case, the power to decide.
Now you're falling into the same sort of argument that I excluded at the beginning, which was I said that the beauty of religion is that there's a bunch of stuff I don't understand.
Let's talk about that one. But after a very short break. So Ben's saying that the beauty of religion is inside of our system, we predict that certain things cannot be known, or we basically predict that we can't make certain predictions. And that's kind of true. There's two ways to determine if a worldview is right. One is basically looking from the ground up, and the other is looking at how it holds together. So it's kind of like if you're determining whether or not a building is stable. One thing is you could look to see if the roof is supported by adequate walls and beams, and if those are supported by yet more walls, and if those are ultimately on a good foundation, if that foundation is supported by firm soil or bedrock or what it's supported by. That's one way. And the other way to see is it just held together, or did they just forget to put the nails in? Did they not screw it together? Did they not connect it? Does it not actually attach? Are there pieces falling off? So if it's brought into one unified whole and it's held together and it's rooted in something, it's good reason that it will stand. So that's what we look for in worldviews. And he's taking the approach of, in my religion, it holds together. He's not arguing that it's grounded in something necessarily, though I'm sure he would argue that elsewhere. But for this point, he's saying, it is a sign that my view holds together, that I predict that certain predictions can't be made. So that's a piece. And that works very well with the fact that indeed, some things we can't predict. And he goes on.
So I can't explain to you how the uncaused self makes decisions.
Well, then I can't.
Ben, that's not the part I wanted you to go on to. We don't think he's an uncaused self. Ultimately, you are caused, well, by God. And God can bring about any type of thing which is not logically impossible, because strictly speaking, that is not a thing. So God can bring about anything. He can bring about you. He did. And he can bring about your soul. He can bring about your soul with certain powers, because he's all powerful. He can lend power to that which he chooses. So not an uncaused self. And the decision is not an uncaused decision. It's a decision which comes from you as a decider. That's a privileged stopping point. Now we have to ask the next question, where did the deciding thing come from? And then this brings us ultimately back to something which contains within its nature not the reason for its own ability to decide or its reason for its own saltiness, but its reason for its own existence, something which is not metaphysically composite.
Explain to you how the uncaused self exists on an atheist framework.
But you have burden and I don't.
I don't think that's the case.
You do, though. I mean, the simple fact is that you are the one who's claiming that a reasonable materialist universe is the cause of all. And so, if that's the case, you do have to explain the mechanism in a way that I certainly do not. My entire philosophy rests on the positing of an entire realm of things I don't understand in terms of their interaction with the world. Now, as I said at the very beginning, that leaves me a giant escape hatch. I'm not going to pretend that that's not a giant escape hatch.
So what do we think about this here? I don't know, kind of. Here's something that I do think he has the burden of proof for. If he's claiming that what we are is only biological beings, and all of our choices spring from biological processes, then he needs to defend that. So if you make a claim, you got to defend it. So he's going to have to defend that one. If he also claims that we have this type of operating system which deludes us into believing that we're making choices or allows us to encounter qualitative aspects of reality, and he claims that that does indeed match reality and our biology, as we've seen, he's going to have to show why on earth that would be if that cannot, strictly speaking, be biologically selected for, given the understanding of like that functionalism, that all the arrows are going from the bottom up and none from the top down. So those things are things I do think he has the burden of proof for. However, I'm going to totally let him off the hook on some of this, where he's totally free to say, I am not convinced with your arguments about free will. I think that you're asserting something here and you have the burden of proof. And no, I can't find the mechanical process that's going on in the brain, the electrical, whatever. I can't find that. But hey, this is a new science. We've only been at this for just so long. We've discovered a lot. And give us time. So, yeah, he can sit there quite happily. So some things, burden of proof, yes. Some things, not so much. And Ben Shapiro and his escape hatch. I suppose you can use the escape hatch, but whenever you cannot use the religious escape hatch, I think you should. So try to avoid that hatch, guys. We don't want to be accused of a God of the Gaps, which we certainly are not. We don't want to just be running off from these arguments. I think we should say what we can say. We should try to spell out what our opponents are actually claiming and see if we can lead that to this logical conclusion. That's what I tried to do with his concept of random and his concept of brute or whatever else he was thinking, to spell out that. I don't think we just need to be jumping through escape hatches.
It acts in practice as a giant escape hatch. It also tends to act as a fundamental principle of faith, right? Again, in every moral realm, right? When we get to the problem of good and evil, right? One of the big questions is, well, how can God allow evil to take place in the world? And the fundamental religious answer, as it has been for thousands of years, is my mind is not God's, which is a giant escape hatch. It also happens to be true from a religious point of view.
Yeah, I think that one particularly is reasonable. I would, maybe we can do another episode on evil. I have one from a while back I would invite you to listen to. And me and good old Pat Flynn, who's popped up a number of times in this episode because he has a lot of good things to say about the PSR and that disconnect between, what is it, biological functionalism, I believe is the right term, etc. But we've talked about that, so you can go and see some of those thoughts. One reasonable answer to the problem of evil is, hey, I would know if I was God, but I'm not God, so I don't know. That's okay. You can certainly say that. Though I think there's plenty more. In general, I think that's a good place to start, to say, hey, I can give you general explanations. I can show you it's not logically inconsistent with the existence of a good God. But I'm not going to pretend that I can give you God's vantage point on the governance of the entire universe through all of time, given all the different possibilities for all creatures who have ever existed. That's something which we fundamentally have to say is outside of our ability to know, unless God somehow fortified us by his grace and infused that knowledge in us. Yeah, it's just not something we're ever going to be able to know unless we're God. But we can certainly look at how God governs the universe. We can certainly get arguments for why God is indeed good. We can see how our finite nature is entailed by the fact that, hey, we're material and we pass out of existence so that other material beings can exist, and how that would involve corruption and death. I mean, there's a lot of answers that we can give. But yes, there is a bit of an escape hatch here. I would add that atheists, it's not like they have an explanation and we have to use an escape hatch. They don't. They simply say it's all meaningless and we don't know why and it just happens and things are the way they are. So I don't think that they're like, they get a win on this one. It's just they're throwing up their hands and we say we can give you a variety of principles and explanations, but we can't give you a specific ultimate God's view answer. Call that an escape hatch, if you will.
All right, folks, we've reached the end of today's show. We'll be back here tomorrow with much, much more. I'm Ben Shapiro. This is the Ben Shapiro Show.
And this is the Cutting the Gordian Knot Podcast. Guys, thanks for listening. I know we got into a variety of things like the PSR and regresses and whatnot, but I hope that explained a little bit on those subjects. And if you want a deep dive, let me know. Thanks, as always, for listening. Don't forget to send me your ideas for a Lenten series. We got to do something considering the Book of Judges, a series on the Rosary, maybe the Minor Prophets. Who knows? I barely even know what I'm going to do for the next week. All right. Well, let's see. Email me at thegordianknot101@gmail.com. Pray that the podcast keeps growing, helping people out. Thank you to everybody who writes in and does reviews. That certainly helps. If you are hearing that, I would certainly invite you to do those things so other people can find it too. All right. God bless. Talk to you next time.